Welcome to Ida History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That is correct. This is Ida History. I am your host, Jeff Wade, and sitting with me is no one. I'm riding solo today. Mark is probably out, you know, shining the hubcaps on the tour van. Speaking of vans and tours, check out one of our walking tours if you're in the southern part of the state, Boise, Nampa, Caldwell, Meridian, where, you know, the whole area. We do our Macabre History of Boise walking tour. We do Macabre History of Nampa walking tour. And then last year, we just introduced a new tour called the Boise's Most Despicable Deeds, a true crime driving tour. And that's the van I mentioned. Yeah, that's Mark's baby, so check that out if you're in the area. It's certainly a good time. But anyway, I'm alone today because we didn't plan on the Covered Wagon Coffee House episode turning into two episodes. I originally had, before we recorded the part one, I had done an interview with Susan Holtz Franceschi, and I was going to put that out as a bonus episode, and then I got another call from another member of the Covered Wagon. I'll introduce you to both of those people here in a bit. So that's why I decided to put this out as another full episode, because I, like I mentioned in the first episode, there's enough content here. I could probably write a short book someday, maybe. Anyway, but before I get into the interviews, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Covered Wagon and some of the stuff that was happening in Idaho. Now, the Covered Wagon Coffee House, if you haven't listened to part one, go back and listen to part one. A lot of this will make more sense to you if you do. So the Covered Wagon certainly wasn't the first group of protests in Idaho against the Vietnam War. If you go back to the college campuses in Idaho, were protesting for years before the Covered Wagon was established. In fact, on the evening of May 6, 1970, the ROTC building up at the University of Idaho in Moscow was burned, not to the ground, but had a significant fire, damaged the building and the classrooms that were in that building. So U of I, and then also over across the border in Washington State University, the ROTC building was burned there as well. The same night in Lewiston, a fire was set at the National Guard Armory, burned 26 National Guard vehicles. Those fires, and actually this happened across the country, ROTC buildings and other military assets were burned that night. And that was in response to the Kent State shootings. But I also want to talk about another protest that the Covered Wagon was involved in, and that happened on November 6, 1971. If you know anything about nuclear testing history, this was the day of the nuclear testing blast at Amchitka Island up in the Aleutian Islands of Alaska. So this was called Project Kanakan, or Kanakan. This was basically, they took a giant nuclear warhead, drilled down deep into the earth, and exploded that bomb just to see what effect on the seismic activity it would have on the island. And you can go on YouTube and actually watch the video of that blast. It's kind of interesting. But members of the Covered Wagon, in response to the testing, they went to Boise and they held a protest where they blocked Boise Avenue with several members of the community in Boise. They blocked it, I can't remember how long it was, but it was basically for the duration of the countdown and the blast. So Mark posted some photos of this protest on our Facebook and Instagram a couple weeks ago, so go back and check that out. I just wanted to mention those couple items just because, like I said, there's so much more to what was going on at this time that we kind of mentioned in the first part. So with that, I think we'll go and we'll get into the first interview. So actually, right before we recorded the first part of the episode, I put out a call on Facebook to some of the Mountain Home history groups, and I asked for people who had been involved in the wagon if they wanted to reach out to me and talk to me. I got two phone calls, and the first phone call I got was from a lady named
It's Susan Holtz Franceschi.
And Susan was a civilian member of the covered wagon. And like me, she is from Mountain Home, so I can definitely appreciate her perspective from a person from town that was involved in the movement. And before I get to the interview, I just want to mention that I was kind of surprised by the phone call. That's why I wasn't really prepared to record it properly. So I just used my microphone for the podcast and put it on speakerphone. So the audio quality isn't the best, but I think it's workable. So anyway, here it is. Enjoy. So we're talking about the covered wagon in Mountain Home, Idaho. So Susan, you said you are from Mountain Home originally, right?
Yes.
And you were you born there, grew up there?
Well, I started first grade there. Okay. And went until I left in 73 and went to Washington.
Okay. So how did you come to be involved with the anti-war movement, the GI movement, and the covered wagon there in Mountain Home?
Well, you know, I think for a college student, because I was going to school in Boise State, and after 10th State, that was a major big thing that happened with the anti-war movement, the fact that, you know, the National Guard killed college students. That was something that made, I think, most college students aware of the anti-war movement. I actually had gone to the University of Idaho my first year of college, and there was an anti-war demonstration. It was 1968, and people, there was like 50 people who marched, and other people threw vegetables at them. So it was quite a change.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
From 68 to 70. I had friends who were involved with the covered wagon, and kind of got involved that way.
Okay.
I don't know if you, Nancy Rhodes was, I went to high school with her. She was involved with the covered wagon.
Okay.
And it was basically through her that I became involved.
Were you involved pretty early on then? I think it started in early 71 and then.
Yeah, I really wasn't really involved until 72.
Okay. Was there a certain event that maybe got you involved, or just you had friends that were there, so they kind of convinced you?
I had friends, and I was, you know, I was anti-war, and I was actually doing my student teaching on the base at the time,
okay.
And then I was demonstrating it against the base.
Yeah.
I have a picture of Nancy and I handing out leaflets on the airbase road.
Oh, wow.
And, there was, you know, a great big demonstration that spring, and
you mentioned, you know, you were teaching on base and demonstrating against the airbase. What was kind of the dynamic? Like, did people know, like, that you worked with on the base, that you were involved with the covered wagon, or how did that kind of feel?
Not really. They really didn't. You know, I was doing my student teaching. That was my final thing to when I graduated. I graduated from college in 72. And so that was really, they really didn't. You know, I did my student teaching and graduated, and that was the end of that. Okay. So.
And then from Mountain Home, you went to Washington, you said?
I did. I went to Tacoma, and I worked with the people at the Shelter Half, which was another GI anti-war coffee house.
Okay. So Mark Lane obviously was kind of the driving force of Mountain Home. Can you tell me a little bit about him, or did you have any much personal connection with him?
He was an ass.
Okay.
Very misogynist. he was, you know, we were there at the same time, and I knew him. He knew who I was. You know, in 73, well, maybe it was late 72. It probably was late 72. You know, the women's movement was coming into existence. There were three of us, a GI's wife, another woman who was from Caldwell, and myself. And we had become you know, involved with the women's movement. Mm-hmm. And Mark was really not happy about that. we were only supposed to think of the GIs, not anything else. Although there had been women's movements, there had been women's meetings at the, when the covered wagon was at the old theater.
Yeah.
But that also involved women GIs, you know, so.
Yeah, then there was the Women's Air Force, and that was a big, it seemed like a pretty big component of the covered wagon and the GI movement as well.
It was.
So, that's kind
of
interesting.
Most of the GI women had left by, you know, late 71. Okay. Early 72. And so anyway, as I said, the three of us were I guess really not making Mark happy. There was a meeting where the three of us were chastised.
Oh wow.
Which isn't in the, you know, I don't know if you've done the read the article, the, I think it's a PhD or anyway, at Boise State, there is a, somebody did a paper on the covered wagon that's at Boise State.
I haven't found that yet, but I will look for it.
Yeah. Well, they didn't talk to the three of us.
Was that was done during the time period?
No.
Or later?
Actually, maybe 10, 15 years ago.
Oh, okay.
So, anyway, as I said, we were chastised quite severely, and because of that meeting, a lot of the GIs, they were out of the military, but they went home. And really, after that, the only people that were still at the covered wagon were Mark, Jimmy Schaefer, and Nancy Rhodes, and maybe her sister, Carolyn. Carol. Hmm. Anyway, it fell apart right after that meeting.
Okay.
Those of us that were chastised, you know, did not feel like going back to those meetings, frankly.
Right.
Yes, as I said. Okay. Now, in that paper that Boise State, Mark talks about how we were diverting the GI movement. That was his take on it. Okay. And yeah, I have nothing good to say about Mark.
Okay, that's good to know, because, I mean, obviously he was very divisive with his theories about the Kennedy assassination and, you know, some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously he wasn't...
Kim Jones.
Yeah, right. And he wasn't liked in the community, of course. I was going to ask you, how about Carolyn Mugger? Did you know her very well?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
She was a very nice woman. I mean, she continued to have, you know, we had the women's movement, women's meetings, but she was not at the covered wagon the night of the chastisement.
Okay.
She was, you know, she still had her own job of photography, and I don't know where she was at that point, but she was not there. And, you know, her and Mark had a relationship. And,
okay. I've
Yes, she was a very nice woman.
I've reached out to her, and she's emailed me back, but she seems pretty busy because she's running Farm Aid now.
Is she?
Yeah. So there's some pictures of her with like Willie Nelson and John Mellencamp online. But yeah, I'm trying to get a chance to talk to her as well. So as far as, I want to talk about the Helping Hand more. I saw your name listed in there a few times, I think in 72, maybe. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Then there was it talked about a trip that you went to Washington, D.C. to meet with our elected officials. Do you remember that trip?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that was Ring Around the Congress, organized by Joan Baez. I also have pictures of myself speaking on the Capitol steps.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that trip? And obviously the meeting with the elected representatives didn't go well, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. I went back east. I wanted to travel back east. And one of the women, her husband had just gotten out of the Air Force. And so we went to Pittsburgh. I stayed with her and her family in Pittsburgh for a couple of months. And we saw on, I think it was the Dick Cavett show, we saw Joan Baez advertising the Ring Around the Congress march. It was a women's and children's march around the Congress. So we went to Washington, D.C. and participated in it. And one of the things they asked was for people to go and see their Congress people. So we went to see, and I don't remember his name. Was he a representative or a senator even? I don't even remember now.
Yeah.
I think that information is in the article, though, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I was just looking at that last night.
Yeah. So we went there. He was not. He was in Idaho at the time, but one of his aides. And, you know, we said we wanted the war stopped, and he basically, it was quite funny, actually, looking back on it. He said, well, was his name Jordan?
Yes, that sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. He said, well, he's not even running next year, so nah, 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 nah.
Okay.
So, yes. It was pretty interesting.
Yeah, sounds like it. Anything else memorable from that trip?
You know, the whole time, that period of time, people were so... The movement was very nice, you know. The people were wonderful. We stayed, they had a lot of people that from the area, and we stayed with a woman there, an older woman. She was probably in her 70s, but she was anti-war, too. And we stayed with her while we were there. Mm-hmm. So I said, people were just amazing. The warmth, the, you know, camaraderie, the giving, people were just absolutely wonderful. So,
do you feel like the GI movement had an impact on ending the war?
I hope it did.
Yeah.
You know, I saw the Vietnam Veterans Wall in Mountain Home, actually, when I was visiting several years ago.
Yeah.
And it was only a piece of the wall. And you look at that and you say, oh my God, you know, if what I did stopped one American boy from being killed, it was worth it.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and that's my, Cindy, one of the other women, you know, she knew a lot more. There really weren't many Mountain Home boys who were killed in Vietnam.
Right.
I think there was one. She was from Caldwell and knew, I mean, she had an algebra teacher whose son was killed 2 weeks before he was supposed to come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the draft, that all, you know, my father actually, even though he was not happy with me about being anti-war, had said if either of my brothers, who were younger than I am, had to go, were drafted, he'd send them to Canada.
Oh, wow.
So, wow. You know, there was a lot of, people did not want their sons to go.
Yeah.
Even if they believed in the war.
Yeah. I'm 36, so I can't imagine. Well, I can't imagine because I saw a lot of the people that I went to high school with go over to Afghanistan and Iraq and get, you know, blown up and shot at over there. So I guess I can imagine a little bit, but there wasn't as much as a social pushback against those two wars.
No, there wasn't.
Yeah. And that's kind of the spirit of that is what, like, I'm really kind of trying to capture with what I'm trying to do right now. Just like, you know, the courage and the guts it takes to stand up to the United States government and the military and say, you know, we don't want this war. Like, it's just incredible to me. And I guess, like, thank you, I guess, is what I want to say to you and, you know, people that were involved in it. Like, it certainly wasn't a small thing to do.
My father blames me for one of his friends having a heart attack because his father, he started in on me about the war. And I guess I, you know, kind of let him have it.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a heart attack the next day.
Oh,
but
no.
He didn't die.
Oh, wow.
But, you know, they weren't used to young women standing up and disagreeing with them.
Yeah. Wow. So I was watching, have you seen the documentaries? There's one called FTA, and then the other one's Sir, No Sir. Have you seen either of those?
I haven't seen, Sir, No Sir sounds really familiar. Mm-hmm. But I don't, not sure I've seen either of them.
Okay.
So Sir, No Sir, huh?
Yeah, it's on Netflix. I think it was made around 2005-ish. And then FTA, I was going to ask you if you, did you ever get a chance to see one of the FTA shows?
I did. I went to one of them.
Was
actually,
that?
The picture, there's a picture, I'm in one of the pictures at the FTA show in the booklet that was in the album.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so I actually have a copy of that coming in the mail today from eBay. So I'll have to look for that.
And actually, the booklet is online at the Smithsonian, too.
Oh, okay. I'll check that out, too.
So,
was that when Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland were there?
Donald Sutherland, yep.
Okay,
yeah. That was when they were there.
Did you get a chance to talk to either of them, or...?
I didn't. Okay. I didn't.
Yeah.
It was a little before I was actually involved with the Covered Wagon. You know, the FTA show probably did help push me that way. So,
okay,
because that was when it was still in the theater. Right. So,
and then were you still involved after it burned and then was moved to the other side of town?
Well, that's really when I became more involved in it. Yes.
Okay.
I was involved during that process and. Until it closed down, basically. Until all the GIs left. So, you know, and then of course, the war ended. And actually, Mark and Jimmy and Nancy all, maybe Carolyn too, got involved with the Native American.
Yeah, at Wounded Knee.
At Wounded Knee, yep.
So was it kind of like a slow fade out, or was there, you know, just one day it was closed and that was it, or...?
Yeah, I think it was more of a slow call. You know, there weren't many GIs coming. There wasn't, you know, protests. There wasn't, I don't think there was a lot of outreach after 70, in 73. From then on, there really wasn't a lot of outreach to the GIs at Mountain Home.
Okay.
By the time I left in April of 73, there really wasn't, there hadn't been anything going on pretty much all of 1973.
Right. Okay. Well, I think that's kind of all the questions I had for you. Do you have anything else that you would like to add about the movement or the Covered Wagon itself or any of the people that you were involved with?
Well, you know, for the majority, the people were wonderful, you know, they really were. They were great, and I met quite a few people. When, as I said, I traveled to the East Coast in the spring of 72, and we stopped at a lot of different colleges and anti-war places on our way out to Pittsburgh. So that was, and the people are, you know, the anti-war people were all just wonderful. And as Cindy said, you know, you kind of had to be there. It was such a different time.
Yeah.
You know, and it's amazing to me that there were so many of us, and it seems like at least today, either they've forgotten what they thought back then, or the people seem to, you know, not have been involved, not have had a feeling about it. You know, the whole thing about the GIs being called baby killers when they came back, I don't think that was as widespread. I think it's become a urban legend.
Mm-hmm.
I think it did happen maybe a couple of times, but almost every GI who was now will say that when they got home, they were called baby killers. I don't think that was true. The majority of the anti-war people did not feel that way.
Okay, that's good to hear. Yeah, that makes my heart a little happier.
I think it's become an urban legend. Because I just don't think it happened as much as it seems like today.
Right. Okay.
So,
all right. I appreciate you talking to me. If you have a chance, can you send me some of those photos you told me about? I would love to see those.
Sure.
Okay. Awesome.
Sure. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
All right. Such great insight from Susan. And those photos, she did send those to me, and I've been posting a lot of visuals on Facebook and Instagram of the covered wagon, so make sure you go check those out. And Susan brought up a really good point at the end of the interview there about the whole spitting on the GIs returning from Vietnam. So this is actually mentioned at the end of the movie Sir No Sir that I talked about in the interview and in the first part of the covered wagon episode. But the whole spitting on GI things, it does actually seem, like Susan said, to be an urban legend. In 1998, a guy named Jerry Lembecki, he published a book called Spitting Image, Myth, Memory, and the Legacy of Vietnam. Now, he went through and he traced... all these supposed stories of GIs being spit on in the San Francisco airport and being called baby killer and stuff like that. If you remember the movie First Blood, Rambo, John Rambo, he does a whole speech about being spit on after returning from Vietnam. Now, Jerry Lembecki, he basically concluded, after all the research he did, that it didn't really happen, or if it did, it was only once or twice. It wasn't this whole big phenomena. And along with that, there's kind of a theory that this story was kind of implanted maybe by the government, you know, not to sound too conspiratorial, but maybe by the government to divide the GI movement from the rest of the anti-war movement. Now, again, there's been no really documentary evidence that this happened. Another writer, a guy named Jack Schaefer, who wrote for Slate, he published articles in 2000, 2004, and 2007 about this. And basically every time a major media outlet would repeat the story of the GIs being spit on, he would publish a challenge for anyone to come forward and give him their story of being spit on. And so far, as far as I know, as far as I've read online, no one's really been able to come forward with an actual documented incident of being spit on. I mean, so I don't know, if you're interested, check out that book and again, watch Sir No Sir. So at this point, I'm going to take a commercial break and it'll come back and talk about the F-111 Aardvark, which is a fighter plane, and then we'll go into our second interview. We appreciate the support of Tammy Guzman and her business, Advanced Services LLC. Advanced Services has the staff and services to empower people with developmental disabilities, provide them with enriching experiences, and enable them to build a strong foundation for themselves and their families. They offer service coordination, medical transportation, a center and community-based adult developmental therapy, and adult day health and supported living services. You can reach Advanced Services at 208-461-0438 or at their website, advancedservicesidaho.com. Advanced Services has offices in Nampa and Emmett to suit your needs.
Hey, Jeff, you remember that house in the Collister neighborhood of Boise we were looking into because of that sadistic priest that lived there?
Man, that's a crazy story, and that house is even crazier.
I was thinking about our friends at Birch Leaf Group, brokered by EXP Realty, and I was thinking, those ladies sure can sling a house. They could even sell the crazy priest house, whether you have a gimp in the basement or a skin shack in the backyard. Kara Harwick and Melissa Call of Birch Leaf, they can get your house sold and sold quick. Contact them at www.birchleafgroup.com or call them at 208-254-0490.
Hey, Mark, we should meet downtown for a cup of coffee.
We should, Jeff.
Where do you want to meet?
I'd like to go where we always go, Flying M Coffee House down in Boise.
Sounds like a good idea, because Flying M Coffee House has been located on the corner of 5th and Idaho in downtown Boise since 1992, and they're currently celebrating their 30th anniversary.
I love it because the coffee house is renowned in the local community for its quirky furnishings, eclectic crowd, high quality coffee, and unique gift shack. They are proud to be voted the best of Boise in the Boise Weekly for over a decade now.
It's awesome. Mark, how do we find them online?
Go to flyingmcoffee.com.
All right, and I'm back. I mentioned I want to talk a little bit about the F-111 Aardvark, which was a fighter aircraft that was used quite a bit during Vietnam. So the General Dynamics F-111 was first put into service in 1967 and served the United States all the way through 1998. I read that in other countries, they used it for another couple decades after that. The F-111, also called the Aardvark, was an attack aircraft, strategic bomber, electronic warfare plane, and was used for recon. Now, if anyone's familiar with Mountain Home, even if you don't know the name of this aircraft, you know this aircraft because it's the one that's in Carl Miller Park up on I think they call that a static display, where it's put on a cement pillar and used for a symbol. Certainly, I remember growing up in Mountain Home, you know, we had picnics under it, you know, it was always cool as a kid to go see the plane, and we called it the Airplane Park. So if you ever go through Mountain Home, you'll see this. If you Google pictures of Mountain Home, it'll come up. It's interesting, though, that that's been used as kind of a community rallying point, or like a symbol for the community of Mountain Home and the support of the Air Force. The covered wagon, though, they had a different take on the F-111. They basically thought that the F-111 was another means to the genocide that they believed that the United States was perpetrating in Vietnam at the time. So Sergeant Paul Williams wrote in The Helping Hand, quote, "The most advanced piece of computerized war machinery known to man for the killing of man." Unquote. That's what he called the F-111. In The Helping Hand, they had all sorts of articles about the F-111, little illustrations. I think one had crashed in near Los Angeles, and in response, The Helping Hand had a little cartoon. I think it was two guys that looked like pilots sitting on the ground in the desert, and there's a sign that said, "Beware of falling planes." It's a little bit of satire of the F-111. So after Mark and I recorded the first part of this episode, I got another phone call from
Paul Williams.
The Paul is originally from the Chicago area. He actually chose to enlist in the Air Force rather than risk being drafted into the Army, which he probably would have been. Paul talks about early on, before he actually joined, he did a delayed enlistment. And while he was on this delayed enlistment, he actually had several other people approach him and ask to take his spot. So, in fact, he did give it away. He talks about one young couple who the wife, he believed, was pregnant. So he allowed the husband to take Paul's spot. So good dude, of course. So when Paul did end up going to basic training, and then he went to school to become a vehicle mechanic, and then he ended up in Mountain Home. So I'll let him tell his story. Here we go.
Prior to my enlisting, I had some interactions with the Draft Resisters League and some peace groups in the Chicagoland area.
Okay.
And I was in essence guaranteed a draft notice, so I decided I would enlist in the Air Force rather than forced into the Army. After that, ended up with orders to Mountain Home, and I knew a little bit about it. He would have been an uncle. Was stationed at Mountain Home when it was a SAC base, and he mentioned old things about Mountain Home. Mountain Home, of course, was nothing like that when I got there in the 70s.
I'm sure, yeah.
Because I believe he was there in the 50s. And, of course, I think the population of the SAC Air Force Base was more than the population of Mountain Home. Yeah, I was in Mountain Home. By that time, I'd pretty much given up the point of doing my 4 years, get the hell out of the Air Force, because it just wasn't for me.
Yeah.
And then kind of any crap happened here and there that really kind of turned me against the military as a whole even more.
Okay.
And then in, let's see now, sometime around August of 71, after attending the FTA show at the Mountain Home Theater.
Yep.
At the Wagon is when I got involved with the Wagon.
Okay. So you remember seeing, like, Jane Fonda and Sutherland?
Donald Sutherland, yeah. Rita, Nina. Yep.
Country Joe.
I actually met Country Joe several times.
Oh, wow.
He actually came here at least twice that I'm aware of to do benefit concerts for us.
Yeah.
I believe usually they were held at Boise High Auditorium, usually.
Okay.
We also had people like Rosalie Sorrells, Utah Phillips, a few other people do concerts for us.
Yeah. So the FTA show kind of brought you in, and you did you become very active in the Wagon after that, or how did that kind of look?
Oh, yeah. I think within my first month or two, I worked as an editor on one of the publications.
Oh, the Helping Hands?
One of the Helping Hands.
Yep.
And then I was there quite a bit. I also lived off base. So we had a lot of interaction with the people there. We used to, we used to do military law counseling.
Yep.
We got, military law briefings from CCCO and United Services Fund. Would make available to us military law cases that became precedents.
Okay.
And, well, of course, we would use that information to help counsel GIs, particularly at Mountain Home. There was and I suspect it was in the Air Force in general. If and when you ever got an Article 15 against you, there were very strict guidelines as to the amount of punishment that can be given to you. Most commanding officers like to break that rule.
Okay.
And so we made it a point to make sure people were educated to the fact that I believe they had three different modes of punishment. They could do, I believe, any combination of two, but they can't do all three.
Okay.
Which they like to do all the time.
Put the hammer down and...
Well, it's most first-termers who don't care about the rules and the regulations because they're not written to help the first-termer. And through the law counseling and everything else that we did, we were able to, I don't know, I wouldn't say necessarily manipulate the system, but force the system to do what they were supposed to do, not what they wanted to do.
Right.
I basically received orders, I can't remember when it was, probably 72, 73. They wanted to send me to Korea, and I didn't like the idea, so I said, no, I'm not going. And they let me get away with it.
Really?
didn't bother going to the orientation meetings. I didn't bother going to any of the scheduled meetings. Actually, I think I went to headquarters and wrote them a nice long letter about how there was no way in hell I was going overseas as a member of the United States military. Just because of my own personal beliefs. And finally, they just gave up and didn't do anything. After that, let's see now. I kind of saw the writing on the wall, and it was things were getting pretty nitpicking about things. They were looking to try to nail people any chance or time they could. So I had decided I'd had enough, so I filed for discharge as a CO. And they, what should have only taken a few months, I think stretched out to over 8. The Air Force found a way to lose all my documentation at least 3 times.
Of course.
Which I had duplicate copies of all of it. There was a new, let's see now, what was it? There was a new regulation that came down that allowed the military to discharge on individuals by getting letters from people who worked with the individual, basically in essence saying that he's open about his opinions. Occasionally he makes sense.
Okay.
My commanding officer at the time called me into his office, asked me if I would be interested in being discharged that way. I said, sure, why not? At that time, informed me that, well, they had already tried, but they couldn't get anybody to write a letter, which, of course, I already knew about.
Yeah.
So I went back to individuals and said, okay, go ahead, write the letters. And I was discharged 28 days later.
Oh, wow.
But, of course, that was after them trying to screw the pooch again. They tried to get me under a general discharge, which there was no reason for. I had no disciplinary action against me. So when it came to do the signing of the documentation, basically I told them to go to hell and walked out of their office. And then later that afternoon, they called me back and said things were taken care of, and I went back and I read the paperwork, and it said honorable discharge, so I said fine and dandy, and they immediately escorted me off the base.
Okay. Did you stay in Mountain Home after that?
Yes, I stayed at Mountain Home for maybe a year, maybe a little less. I think I was in the Air Force, let's see now, about 3 years. I think 3 years, a few months, rather than all 4 years.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about some of the stuff that happened at the wagon? Were you involved in a lot of the protests there?
After the FTA stuff, yes. We did a couple of marches in Boise. I know we had a big one in Mountain Home where we basically marched to the base. And, of course, the Air Force overreacted over the whole goddamn thing. And that was even after we had a sit-down meeting with the base commander, letting them know exactly what they were what we were going to do and the time frame and where we would be and everything else. And, of course, they didn't believe a word of it. And they wrote communications to the Pentagon that they were worried we were going to overrun the base.
Oh, wow.
And they, my understanding, they also had a group of, I don't know if it was National Guard or reserves or what, but we actually had some Army people stationed out in the desert with helicopters that were ready to come in. And it was typical overreactionary stuff by the military.
Yeah.
I mean, we knew a lot of what the base was saying about us because we ended up with a lot of copies of the communications that they were sending to the Defense Department.
Do you know how those were obtained?
Apparently by people who had access to them.
Okay.
There were a lot of people on that base that were sympathetic. And there was a lot of stuff that went on that I'm not even too sure the military knew what was going on. But
yeah. So I'm reading through one of the Helping Hands right now, and I see August 7th and 8th.
The March through the desert?
So
from Boise to Mountain Home, or from Mountain Home to Boise?
Yeah, so that was in August 1971. So, yeah, were you involved in that one?
No.
Okay, so that was right before you joined, probably. Or you
started. Yes, okay. That was... actually, that was a pretty big to-do.
Yeah.
They had planned to do an information raid at Morrison Knutsen, which, of course, no longer exists in the way that it did.
Right.
And so they gathered at Morrison Knutsen and staged a bunch of people on all the floors and had somebody hold an elevator, and then passed out publications of the Helping Hand and some other stuff. The reason they hit MK was because of I think it was Brown Construction at the time.
It was like a conglomerate of different companies, right?
Right. They were actually building roads throughout Southeast Asia. But they were also building tiger cages.
Right.
Which is kind of what we were protesting.
And then I understand that Captain Larry Knutsen was the great grandson of one of the founders, and he spoke at that. Do you remember him at all?
Yeah, I do. He didn't last long. They wanted these officers out. Hmm. They did not like the fact that these gentlemen were vocal.
Right.
Particularly officers. And then what really stuck in their craw was the, I would say, half of the JAG office at the Air Force Base were all first-termers. Most all of them were against the war, and a lot of them helped us in the background.
Okay.
Which really pissed the military off.
Do you think that helped some people avoid prosecutions?
Well, I believe it did, only because certain points of the law were pointed out. Of course, Mark was a pretty good defense counselor and was pretty good dealing with distractions and changing focus.
Okay.
He was kind of a sly dog that way. There were couple cases that I sat in on at the military base dealt with court martials that were trying to nail upon people where they had little to no evidence. So, very different times.
Yeah, can you tell me more about Mark Lane and what you thought of the man?
Well, I'd heard different things, but I based most of my experience with him and my opinions of him as it related to the anti-war and the wagon. There were probably some issues that I didn't particularly agree with, but that happens in every human interaction.
Sure. Yep. All right. What can you tell me about the night of the fire?
Not a whole hell of a lot. I was actually... actually, I believe I was on base at the time. I don't know if anybody ever really knows what happens. There were high suspicions that it was arson, but I don't think anything was ever proved of it.
Right.
We were hassled often enough by the people in the nearby bars, and the local law enforcement didn't much seem to give a shit about protecting people. So there was a point where some threats were made, and state police contacted us, and we basically told them we'd be perfectly okay, and then we all went out and armed ourselves.
Okay.
And then, oh, let's see now, who was the sheriff that, or chief of police then? I think it was Nelson. I'm not positive, but I think that was his name.
Yeah, I think you're correct. Nelson.
He and a state trooper came by and basically said that people from the Twin Falls area had been talking up a storm, and there was talk that they were coming to Mountain Home to kick some ass.
Oh, wow.
So we said fine and dandy that we didn't need their help, and several of us went and got our weapons.
Wow.
And when the police made it a point to come by occasionally, and when they saw everybody standing around with pistols, bows and arrows, rifles, shotguns, I think it was decided that they might be anti-war, but they're definitely not pacifists like everybody believed.
Right, yeah, well. Do you remember any violent confrontations in town with any of the townspeople? Was there any fights or anything like that that had broken out that you remember?
There was an assault at the front door. Actually, I think it happened a couple times, but the last time, I think it was averted by one of the people who stopped by the wagon to kind of check it out, who was, I believe, a black belt at the time, and apparently he stopped it. The only other time I'm positive of, and that's because I was there, was we had a small vigil outside the Air Force base, and there were probably, well, maybe a half a dozen of us, and I think we were also handing out the latest publication. There were a couple lifers who decided they wanted a piece of somebody, so they tried to intimidate the group, and I think they physically assaulted Tom Spaulding.
Okay.
And it was all within sight of the main gate. The main gate wasn't going to do a damn thing about it.
Right. So I'm looking at the helping hand right now, and I'm thinking this is maybe the same event, but it said that you were thrown against a sign during a scuffle up near the front gate. Do you remember that?
That's the same instance where Tom got beat up.
Yeah, so it says Sergeant Paul Williams was violently thrown against a sign when he proceeded to the SP shack to obtain assistance. So it looks like you were trying to get some help, and then you're tossed against the sign.
Well, and the guys at the main gate knew these guys were Air Force because they just went on the base, did a U-turn on base, came off base, and then parked right outside of where we were.
Okay. So certainly they could have helped if they chose to.
Well, they could have, knowing that these people were military. But, of course, they chose not to, which is pretty typical.
Right. Well, anything, any other memories that have sparked while we've been talking that you want to tell me about?
Not a whole lot, other than, let's see now. Well, yeah, we dealt with a lot of things. sometimes not too well, but we still tried to muddle through it.
Right.
I mean, you have to admit, most of these guys, including myself, were 19, 20 years old.
Sure, yeah.
Kind of knee-deep in shit. You know, it actually took me quite a bit to even go down to the wagon because I knew how nasty that they were treating some of the individuals, some of the crap that they ended up getting.
Right.
I will have to admit I didn't get half the crap that some of them did, but it still rolled downhill occasionally.
Sure.
But yeah, we used to late night gatherings, and then everybody would drive down to the Indian bathtubs in Bruno and soak in the hot tubs. Huh. Unfortunately, it's dried up now.
Right.
Yeah, I still have actually quite a bit of the literature back then. Yeah, a bunch of the flyers we made, and I know in one instance they were trying to court-martial two guys for a moratorium that they were going to do, and they were going to court-martial them over the wording of the moratorium, and unfortunately, I was the one who wrote the pamphlet.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And they were passing it out on base?
They were passing it out, so they were going to arrest. They arrested them and took them and tried to court-martial them, but there was no way that they could prove that they wrote it. Just because they were handing it out didn't mean that didn't support the charges.
Okay.
All kinds of little crap like that.
Right. Wow. Again, thank you very much. It's so incredible to talk to somebody who was involved in the movement. Because, you know, doing a lot of history, mostly what I do is read black and white, you know, so it's interesting to add another dimension of, you know, someone that was involved. So I appreciate talking.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Paul. Have a good day.
All right, Jeff. Bye-bye.
All right, and that was my interview with Paul Williams. Let me tell you guys about one more thing before I let you go. Paul mentioned this, just how important the military law counseling was for a lot of airmen. And he mentioned two airmen that were arrested for distributing anti-war material on the base. And that was Thomas Spalding. He mentioned my name. The other one was James Schaefer. And these two fellas came to be known as the Mountain Home Two. So they were arrested, and they were going to be put to trial. Their defense attorneys argued that the law was unconstitutional, that they should have, even as airmen under military law, should be allowed to have that freedom of speech and be able to speak out against the war. Now, the military judge that was in charge of the case, he refused to rule on that because he knew that he probably would have gotten a little hot water if he were to overturn a case based on a constitutional question like that. So the case went to trial, at least for James Schaefer. They were tried separately. The case for the prosecution actually fell apart when the military policeman misidentified Schaefer, and then he was acquitted quickly after, and then the prosecution actually dropped the case on Mr. Spalding as well. So it just goes to show how arbitrary and, you know, difficult a time that a lot of airmen had back in this time. And I think I'll leave with that. Honestly, I've got more to say, more I can say about the Covered Wagon Coffee House. But I've been beating this horse for about 2 hours now, so I think I'm going to go and leave it at that. Maybe I'll do another project with it someday. I definitely think it should be remembered. But with that, I'm going to say see you later, and I think we'll be back next week. Oh, yeah. We mentioned we have an interview with Adam Fleck with Alliteration Ales. So that's actually going to be our next regular episode. So stay tuned through that, and thanks for listening. But members of the Covered Wagon, in response to the testing, they went to Boise and they held a protest where they blocked Boise Avenue with several members of the community in Boise. They blocked it. I can't remember how long it was, but it was basically for the duration of the countdown and the blast. So Mark posted some photos of this protest on our Facebook and Instagram a couple weeks ago, so go back and check that out. And that's all I got to say about the Covered Wagon for now. I think I done beat this topic to death. Anyway, we'll be back with Adam Fleck with Alliteration Ales next week, so make sure you check that out. And thanks for listening. Bye.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's Counting.